More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of I'm Afraid of Americans, a book release party on Saturday, June 8th from 6 to 7 p.m. at Books Around the Corner in Gresham. The stories of I'm Afraid of Americans are set in a high school in Los Angeles County in the 1980s. They show students, teachers, and support staff busy with daily details, but also living in the history, geography, and dislocations of their time. Author M.F. McAuliffe will read from the collection of stories and sign books. Again, that's I'm Afraid of Americans, a book release party on Saturday, June 8th from 6 to 7 p.m. at Books Around the Corner, 40 Northwest 2nd Street in Gresham. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
Hello, listeners. This is Wider Window Poetry. I'm your host, Teal Ansari, and I have a guest for you this month. But before we get to the guest, I'm going to read a poem by Agostino Neto, which is a name that may not be familiar to you. Agostino Neto was born in Angola in 1922, and he was the son of a pastor and a professor. Angola at that time was a Portuguese colony. Neto went and studied medicine at the University of Lisbon and became a doctor, and he was also politically active with the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola. And Neto would become the first president of Angola when it achieved its independence in 1975, and all this time he was also writing poetry. Agostino Neto's publications include the poetry collection Sacred Hope, 1974, which was during the liberation struggle in Angola. He was also a founding member of the Angola Writers Union and the Center for African Studies in Lisbon in Portugal. His literary honors include the Conference of Afro-Asian Writers Lotus Prize, and he passed away in 1979. And this poem by Agostino Neto is titled Havamos de Voltar, We Shall Return. To the houses, to our crops, to the beaches, to our fields, we shall return. To our lands, red with coffee, white with cotton, green with maize fields, we shall return. To our mines of diamonds, gold, copper, oil, we shall return. To our rivers, our lakes, our mountains, our forests, we will return. To the shade of the mulemba, to our traditions, to the rhythms and bonfires, we shall return. To the marimba and the kisanga, to our carnival, we shall return. To our beautiful Angolan homeland, our land, our mother, we shall return. We shall return to liberated Angola, independent Angola. That was Agostino Neto. And now I'm going to introduce our guest for this month, Armin Tolentino, who earned his MFA at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. His poetry has appeared in numerous literary journals, including Common Knowledge, Arsenic Lobster, that's a great name, Hyphen Magazine, and The Raven Chronicles. His debut poetry, meant to bring it home alive, was published by Alternating Current Press in 2019. And I just want to say, if you ever thought of hosting a poetry show, it's a great way to have people give you free copies of their new book. Armin is a former Oregon Literary Arts Fellowship recipient. He's been a finalist for the Red Hen Press Benjamin Saltman Poetry Award and also the Kundeman Poetry Prize. He's a phenomenal clapper, believe it. I've heard him clap. Mediocre ukulele player, which I cannot testify to personally, and a bumbling but enthusiastic fisherman. And you can find more about him at armino.com. Armin, take it away.
Thank you so much for having me, Teal. This poem is called Caterpillars. When we were little, we'd delight in the season of caterpillars. They'd crawl on the trees and we'd scoop up a couple to wriggle in our palms or tickle our legs. When I moved away, I learned most people call them leeches. But where I was born, we had so few words, everything had to share a name or it went its existence unmentioned. For example, wolf could mean pet, but also mother, or rusted machine, or tree where tired angels rest. When I first moved, believe me, there were lots of misunderstandings. I just point to things constantly. That's what I mean. You call it what? A gaggle of caterpillars could nuzzle a dead wolf down to bone in a few hours. That was great joy and relief, especially if the wolf belonged to one of us. Where I was born, love meant blind, the tea that soothes stomach ulcers, or anything you felt all the way to your pinky toes. I've been away a long time from where I was born, but every now and then I still make mistakes. I'll reminisce and share a memory like the troll we loved to rub as kids in the woods. And when I get blank stares, I just say, "Oh, I guess you had to be there," which I've learned in my new home means connection lost, reboot, or I've given up on trying, or you will never know the real me. I think this happens a lot, and it just happened recently with the tragedy in Notre Dame, where people see visions of religious icons in various spaces, and some of them are really fantastical places. So this is sort of inspired by that idea. In the Dunkin' Donuts, where the Virgin Mary appeared on an apple fritter. Every day since that report, I've ordered a fritter and sat by the window to inspect its frosting for Teresa's laugh lines, Jesus's beard, anything to prove there's more for me today than coffee and Subways and a burnt-out porch light I've yet to fix. God didn't have to make it so hard, you know, if he wanted me to believe. He didn't have to let miracles run dry in my century. Another weekday, another secular fritter. From the window, I see a boy chase a lost ball into a bush. Thank God it's not burning. Just wanted to share a poem that's in the last section of this book, which explores the ideas of apocalypse and extinction. And thinking about the right characters to speak about this, one of them is a bone collector from the 1800s. So I'll read a poem in this bone collector's voice. A refugee of the bone wars. It's a nervy gambit. 1,000 up front for fair across the boreal sea. Humid days of steamed milk air. Plesiosaurs nipping the ferryman's oars. 3 days until land, then the balance paid on the muddy banks of the Mesozoic. Moldy bushmeat, a knowledge of mushrooms, that's all the ferryman has to offer, plus a prayer for safe passage that neither of us holds faith in. If God is good and made us in his image, then all men are carpenters, sawing and sanding and later resenting how nothing turns out the way we imagined. I'm done with the bone wars, deep in the marl pits where we'd pile the mule carts with all of God's failures discarded in limestone. And what of it, a payday for skulls, if my own rests snug in the Winchester crosshairs of a marsh or cope goon high on the ridge, thumbing the hammer? It takes no tea leaves to divine our die-off, the furless mammals of Como Bluffs, feeding on gold, blind to the asteroids. If Neanderthal roots are family tree, then we are each children with hands of the spear maker. We still have not fashioned a weapon so fearsome it repels the will of the Lord. No longer for fortune, I prospect only a soft place to hide. I bushwhacked cycads, machete dragonflies wide as owls to build here my shelter. A sauropod palace, scarf-jointed femurs, archway of vertebra. I'm the lone working organ inside this dead beast. I'll ride out the reckoning as refugees do, bargaining every drop of blood I can spare for enough to wager tomorrow. If Eden was sowed on a forsaken soil of a scorched first creation, then we must uncover the book before Genesis and brace ourselves for its ending. So many creatures once shaped by his hands now erased, and of all of his children, he must regret us the most.
Okay, so we're going to come back to some poetry in a bit, but I'd like you to talk about the process that led to this book. Was it sort of just poems that you'd written over time and then thought, hey, I could put these into a manuscript? Or did you have sort of a manuscript structure in mind throughout?
Great question. A little column A and a little column B there. The book is in three parts. And part one and part three are definitely interrelated poems. The first section were pieces that I worked on during my MFA that are about a guy lost in space. And to think about what would match it with the third section, I started writing these poems that had me explore the idea of, as I said, apocalypse and extinction, and the idea that, oh, there's a lot I could explore within that and how they would all belong. To structure it then into what would be a full-length collection, I had to think what could exist sort of in the middle. And it wasn't just sort of all the poems I had, but more so which poems spoke to the same themes I was feeling in sections one and three about distance and disconnection.
So I think extinction obviously is one of the concerns in this collection. It's even sort of suggested in the title, we meant to bring it home alive. And you've been writing these poems for some time. I can remember you reading some of them, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So now that it's kind of, I think, a very present concern in people's minds, does it give sort of a different cast to the poems? Do you feel differently about reading them in a current climate?
Absolutely. You know, as you were saying, Teal, you know, back in the day, I was reading and starting with some of these poems in different forms. And really, many of them started in about 2011, because I wasn't thinking necessarily about extinction, but apocalypse. In 2011, a preacher, Reverend Harold Camping, had predicted the end of the world through, I think his radio station was Radio One. And enough of his listeners and followers believed it, where they were selling their property and repenting, and you know, there were billboards all over the country, and I was finding that extremely fascinating of how people really believed this, and other people were making a huge joke of it, and yet there was scientific evidence that the world has vanished, has been destroyed multiple times. So I was thinking about it more from this scale of time that was much vaster than us as humans. And of course, there's no way I can deny the absolute damage that we as humans are causing. The fact that we're calling this era the Anthropocene, if I'm pronouncing that properly. What used to be called the Holocene is now the Anthropocene. And so to imagine that within the 5-6 years that I was really building this out, I think the awareness of this recent sixth wave of extinction has just becoming so much more prevalent. So I think about it both as far as reading these poems about extinction, thinking about what we are currently doing, but thinking about how minuscule we are as human beings in the scale of existence, and to remind myself, I think, as I read it, that there will always be something that comes after us.
So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like you to read a couple of poems from the first section and sort of introduce us to Space Boy.
Sure. Let me start out with the poem that opens up this series. And so the poem that opens up this series is called Dragon Scrimshaw. And this whole series, a lot of it was inspired by Moby Dick. I'd read Moby Dick and was just amazed by just the amount of time someone could be away from home for work, and thinking about how communication happened, where letters could be passed from one ship to another, and you never knew if they made it to wherever they were intended to go. So Space Boy comes in the next poem, but I'll just start with this to give some groundwork. So Dragon Scrimshaw. We meant to bring it home alive. The dragon we found writhing on the ice fields of the Arctic Sea, stranded by its shattered wing, fixed its helpless weight to the ship's side and offered it our rationed meat. Try as we did to rinse its yellow eyes of salt, still it died. One harpooner plucked a tooth to Scrimshaw. Captain found out about the thieving Scrimshander, lashed his legs 7 times, screaming that a dead dragon was still worth more than 1,000 barrels of oil. The salt would preserve it. But we begged to cut it loose, let it sink into the sea. Too heavy to tow, and sharks were nipping chunks of meat from its belly. But Captain said the corpse would pay its weight in gold. We sailed a slow route home, the extra weight a burden. Without wailing, killed time with smoke and Scrimshaw, dreamt of women soaked in syrup and wine who would meet us at port. In spring we crossed Cancer, and skies erupted as if the dragon had breathed its doomed flames into the thunderclaps. The sea turned black beneath us. The storm waged an assault, the deck punished with rain until each man was swallowed by salt water or stabbed by screws of lightning, except me. The weight of the first mate's body sheltered me until the heartbeat of the sea slowed to near stillness. I drifted alone and scrimshawed my daughter's name on teeth I pulled from the mouth of the dragon to count each passing day. By 30,000, I'd run out of meat, hardtack, and cod. I sliced the creature's back. Cubes of scaly meat I dried on the deck. Old gray flesh packed hard with salt. When one day I saw the sun eclipsed by a swarm of dragons, I knew I'd never see my home again. The weight of their shadows smothered me as they crossed heaven. I scrimshawed my questions to God on vertebrae as I drifted a borderless sea. I've tossed out the spyglass because I know what I'll see. Blue on blue horizon where sky and water meet. I've burnt the sails for soot to color my scrimshaw. I never seem to run out of bones. I drink buckets of salt water, but I never seem to run out of life. I wait for nothing, and nothing comes as the centuries drag on. So in this first section, there's a guy named Space Boy who's lost in space. But many of the poems are actually in the voice of his brother, who's still on Earth. And so that idea of like how they communicate to each other from these expanses. So this poem is about Space Boy when he and his brother are a child, and it's in the voice of his brother. Space Boy's first mission, age 12. A dozen poplar logs, dried and light as styrofoam, dragged from the forest and fastened with jute we snuck from Dad's toolbox. Summer vacation testing buoyancy on the lake from whose center an island bloomed, glittering alien planet, and no way to know how many fathoms we'd sink if our knots should relax or the woods suck too much water. The night before our launch, I asked What do you think we'll find? He was packing provisions, fish hooks, compass, chocolate chip cookies, a book mapping stars. Mammoth bones or ruins, probably, he shrugged. Just hope we don't see any dragons. Whalers used to say a dragon at sea meant you'd never make it back home. Next morning, I faked sickness and confessed to our parents the summer-long project when he didn't come home by dinner. Dad borrowed a neighbor's skiff, and my brother was grounded, telescope privileges forbidden as well. He wouldn't even look at me. At least you didn't see a dragon, I said. He stared out the window. It was dark too soon already. His anger, my gratitude, two stars to navigate us to the equinox. His words fogged the window. How do you know I didn't? And so many of the poems are letters from the brother to Space Boy. So I'll just read this one. A letter that Space Boy never received. You wouldn't know at T-7, I shut my eyes from the shuttle's exhaust. A blossom of orange that burnt itself into gray. Couldn't shake the feeling you just strapped yourself inside the throat of a dragon. The crowd sang goodbye. At zero, you broke the thick quilt of cumulus, but I never watched you go. Another confession. The summer we built a log raft with twine, a handbook on knots, and no knowledge of nautical physics. I wasn't too sick to join in the journey. Just a co-pilot frozen by the unshakable thought the lake was alive and halfway across would love us too much to ever let us go. If I sank, what would Mom have to lay in my coffin? Would my soul snap loose from its anchor of bones? How would it find the surface? That morning you sailed, offered her prow to the waters give, but I witnessed nothing, locked in the bathroom, crying too much to wish you good luck. Since blast off, I've trained my eyes to stay open, to stare at stretches of sky without tiring. So patient, I now can spot black migrations of midges against empty miles of blue. Brother, I promise I will not blink. I will not flinch. Pull back this time. I will not miss 1 second of your return.
So as a poet, as a writer, I'm sure you've received the advice, write what you know, which I always find a little difficult because one of my favorite genres is science fiction, which I feel like this collection, you know, the Space Boy poems kind of explicitly, but all of this collection, I would argue, could be considered science fiction. And science fiction is explicitly about things you don't know, maybe things that can't possibly be, but that you imagine.
Yeah.
So how do you resolve that with the write what you know advice?
Oh boy, yeah. Oh, I think about that all the time, Teal. That write what you know, for me, that advice is comparable to in high school where they teach kids how to do essays, and they teach you the structure of a 5-paragraph essay. The idea is that it is safe, it's easy to use, and maybe, you know, it helps you build some general skills. So I have no problem with people writing what they know, especially if that's where their inspiration, their passion, the thing they want to explore comes from, if it's something internal that they want to process in this world. And at the same time, it is critical for us to have the imagination and to exercise the imagination to think about what is impossible or doesn't seem possible right now. The reason that speculative fiction is so important, or sci-fi is so important, is because it allows us to imagine a different world. And none of us should be complacent or happy with the world we have as is. That's why it's so critical for people of color and writers of color to be able to access these imaginative spaces to say there's a world and a way beyond what we have now. I think many of us come to writing for various reasons, but one of the most important things for me is just that idea to explore and learn. So maybe it's more about writing what you want to know, writing to know, and that is your avenue to learn. And so, like you're saying, like these poems, for me, the exploration of writing them allowed me to just think about my own internal feelings, but just ideas that I didn't have before writing these poems. And so that was only possible to think about it through the fantastical, something outside of myself.
Great. So this is probably a good spot to sort of wander off and start doing kind of the boring questions that all poets get asked. How did you come to start writing poetry? How old were you?
It was probably in middle school. And you know, honestly, I was writing. The first time I remember trying to write a poem was to impress a girl. You know, that's a common thing that I think a lot of people sort of engage with poetry, thinking that it is this beautiful, romantic thing that you can do.
And did that work for you?
It didn't. No, it worked for me that I fell in love with poetry. And I think people appreciated seeing the efforts I did, but it wasn't the type that could woo anybody. What I could say is that, you know, being able to understand that there was a way to use words and to feel there was an architecture to building words and organizing, making is so natural to human beings, first of all, just the idea of making, creating, and to think that you could do it with something that's so innate to human beings, which are words and language. It felt natural to me, especially as, you know, a really introverted, scared kid at a lot of times, a kid that didn't know how to process his feelings or to express himself to other people. Being able to have the avenue of being able to write words really carried me through middle school, through high school, during some difficult times. And I can say that for me, the fact that writing is hard and I keep doing it just tells me that it's ingrained in me. It's not something that I can shake at this point.
So I think it's interesting that you use the word architecture and the word natural kind of in the same breath there. Architecture is really an artifice. Yeah. And sort of in connection with that, one of the poems you just read was a formal poem, although that may not have been apparent in listening to it. And so, you know, many poets are sort of opposed to formal poetry. They feel it's too constraining and too artificial. So there's that word artifice again. Mm. Can you talk about that a little bit? Why would you put the words architecture and the words natural in the same sentence?
Wow, great question. It makes me think, like, why do I feel that's true? And you're repeating it back to me makes me think, like, is that accurate? And I do feel it's true that there is the spontaneity of language in that you don't have to actively teach people to speak. Everyone has language, even people who may not have the faculty of vocalization still have language. So we know that that is just something that is already part of us, part of our DNA as human beings. But the idea of then, how do we shape words? How do we shape this language? That is the architecture. And that takes intention. So even if you don't have to try to communicate because that is innate, the architecture of communicating with intention is what poetry is all about. So the idea for some people, you know, I think a big question about whether people want to use forms or not, or how much architecture versus spontaneity exists in their writing, is really a question of what are they trying to explore with the power of words, but also what is their comfort level with order or disorder. Some people really care about the tightness of language and the order and structure, and that the intent that they have is that level of control. And we see that in different writers. Others want it to be really spontaneous and free-flowing. There is still a building of it, and you know, the architecture of a skyscraper is still architecture, just as the architecture of a sandcastle is still architecture. It is still some sort of intention of creating something with a vision in mind.
Okay, So let's hear a few more poems, and then I'm going to ask you to talk about David Raup.
Yeah.
Let's hear some poems first.
Sure. Dinosaur Relief poems? Would we be interested in that? Yeah, how about let me offer that. So again, in that third section of the book, that was inspired by the prophecy that the world would end in 2011, I was traveling across the country, and I was just imagining what is it to travel across a country and thinking about these geographic spaces where we knew we have great evidence of extinction. So many amazing dinosaur fossils have been found in the West as you travel across. And so I have a series of poems then in this third section in the voice of a guy driving across the country, thinking about what apocalypse means, even if he doesn't believe in the religious context of it, knowing that there is absolute proof that extinction has happened in this world. So this poem is called In Mission, Kansas, on the Brink of the Latest Apocalypse. Can you forgive us tonight one last time for our dumb mutton habits as we while our final hours of this snake bit creation, same as our race has for 2,000 centuries, coveting our neighbor's slippers and bandsaw, working a graveyard shift on the Sabbath. At Quick Trip Gas off I-35, a dropout stuffed strawberry Pop-Tarts and Kotex in her hoodie's deep layer below her thieving heart. Can she too be forgiven? Or the cashier who sees and just doesn't care and sullies your name every time the Chiefs play. How about the truck drivers trading amphetamines and astronomers on NPR mocking the end times who claim with their prying impertinent telescopes that if you built the sky, it was a slapdash operation beyond your control, that sinkholes of black gravity corrode as rust does the edges of everything you made. Can I be forgiven for filling my tank as if I still had 400 miles of road in my lifetime? Forgive my not knowing the act of contrition anymore, for wasting my last wish on molasses smoked brisket rather than salvation. Forgive God my glee as I drive toward the widest horizon I've seen, dawn like the drawbridge of the devil's jaw. Forgive my not stopping as morning unhinges my anticipation for burning stone for ample fire. And so I was thinking a lot about different theories on extinction, and one of them is this idea of a field of bullets, which is a gruesome way of imagining that extinction is not based on adaptability, that if you took all the species and put them in a field and bullets were just striking at random, some percentage would all die. And so this poem is called Field of Bullets, Medicine Bow, which is a place in Wyoming. $45 a regular unleaded. My gas tank is a graveyard on fire. Most every species that once drew breath is fossil now, or oil. If I'm to die in this latest apocalypse, what would my body ignite? Whose escape could I fuel? Wyoming, too, is an unmarked grave, and the wind shears off an inch each year to flash the bones of another failure felled by the hard hand of cataclysm. All my escape routes are paved on the backs of a billion extinctions. As the Cretaceous closed, did you gather your children in a field to graze while you scooped in your two open palms the width of continents, a handful of celestial stones to scatter like snowflakes upon their gaping mouths? Or did you close one eye and aim?
So you cite David Raup in your author's notes. Can you just sort of briefly introduce his work for the benefit of our listeners?
Absolutely. And I just think it was fortuitous that I stumbled upon his work when I was just starting the series. And so I was introduced to David M. Raup. Am I saying that right? Raup, who was a statistical paleontologist through a book he wrote called Extinction, Bad Genes or Bad Luck. And I had him, so he just explored the idea of paleontology from a statistical perspective, which I never realized paleontologists did. You know, I imagine paleontologists the way people see it in sort of Jurassic Park, someone who like looks at bones in the desert, versus people realizing, oh, well, there's math that we can look at, especially the idea that he was able to explore of, well, eventually all species will go towards extinction versus towards a more speciation. So if you think of all the genuses that have ever existed, most of them don't exist now. And so it's both remarkable to think how many creatures have died throughout the history of living things, and yet that we persist somehow. And I was amazed by that. So his work, first, it was just so accessible for someone like me who doesn't have the math or science background to be able to understand really deep things. And yet I just found it an amazing piece of work. And so a lot of the theories and sort of statistical puzzles that he offers in that book became part of this series for me.
So there's a really strong evolutionary theme and paleontological theme in this collection. At the same time, many of the poems are sort of in a dialogue with God and with the divine aspect of extinction or aspect of cataclysm. And, you know, many conservative religious people would be sort of opposed to the evolutionary aspect. So do you feel there's, I don't want to necessarily get into your personal beliefs unless you're comfortable sharing that, but do you feel there's a tension there?
Oh, absolutely. So I was raised Catholic. I'm not practicing now. And that's what really struck me as I was sharing when I was first thinking about this idea of what would an apocalypse look like, or why don't we take apocalypse seriously? And I don't. So in 2011, as I was hearing these prophecies on the radio and people saying like, okay, in a couple hours, the world's supposed to end, and I'm driving straight through Jersey to Portland, Oregon, and bleary-eyed and smoking cigarettes, which were killing me at the time, and imagining like, oh, I clearly wasn't taking this seriously while other people were. And so it was sort of that question of, well, if I know that extinction has happened catastrophically, why don't I believe it's possible when I hear it from the perspective of sort of a religious entity? And so it really fascinated me to think that, as you're pointing out, Teal, apocalypse and extinction are two things that are not believed by the same camps. So if we think about how people who read the Bible as literally as possible don't believe that there's such a thing as evolution, and therefore there has never been these extinction periods. Even if we think like the great flood of Noah would be something like an extinction period, but actually everything was saved. It doesn't talk about any animals dying off, unless you hear that like Irish song about the unicorns, right? That's why we don't have unicorns, right? Because they were prancing around instead of getting onto the ship. So they missed the voyage. Whereas on the other hand, people who believe solely in evolution and have no belief in a greater divinity having created anything, if it's all based on random chance, the end result of extinction still looks like an apocalypse, I imagine, whichever angle you're coming from. So it really fascinated me to think about, like, what would it be like for a secular person to think about the possibility of divinity through this driver who's thinking about what would it be like if there really is an apocalypse, because I've seen evidence of extinction. And what is it like then for the foil, which would be a bone collector in the 1800s who lives in a very religious time where the Bible was taken as fact, to now imagine, oh my gosh, there's all these bones in the ground. What could this mean if there were all these things that weren't mentioned in the Bible? And then what would it mean if there is such a thing as a loving God that causes such destruction? So I was really sort of playing around with those ideas. I use a lot of smaller poems within that use Bible text to think about the Bible text and the question of this idea of extinction. And imagine that the idea of probably the most famous extinction would be the one at the end of the Cretaceous when all the dinosaurs died out. For one thing, because dinosaurs are amazing and we love seeing them, so they're more interesting than when we see like sponges die out in the Cambrian or whatever that period was. But it was also so catastrophic, you know, that it actually was pretty much instantaneous, the destruction that happened when the asteroid struck. And so thinking about like, oh, is an asteroid sort of like God throwing a stone at you? Is this God stoning you in this moment? And why would he do that to his creation? So all of those things certainly played in. Even if I'm not a religious or practicing person now, you can't get away from how you've been raised as far as the mythology and the tropes that live with you forever.
So how about if you maybe read us one of those poems with the biblical epigraph and sort of explain how that fits in with it then?
Yeah, I'd love to. So these smaller poems are a form called a triolet, and I really enjoyed that because they required some repeating words, and they're all titled after lines of scripture that I thought would really match this theme. So this one comes from Book of Isaiah, chapter 43, verse 5. I think I'm saying that right. I haven't been to church in a while. Fear not, for I am with thee, says the one whose pouch is packed with asteroids and whose fingers licked can pinch out the sun, who strikes dead your firstborn and sheep when annoyed with his salt shaker of locusts and asteroids. Fear not, but know he began with a void, and since the first Sabbath has mourned what he'd done. He watches while thumbing his worrystone asteroids, etched with the names of your daughters and sons. And this next one is from the Gospel of John, chapter 8, verse 7. He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone. He sighs and steps forward, the only one. He kneels and packs the dirty snow into a comet. His hands grow numb with the ache of always being the only one. He folds in stars and iridium, so dense he's certain with just one blow he'll leave creation barren. No one left praying as the crater fills with snow.
Can you tell us some particular experiences you've had that were very fruitful in terms of writing?
Oh, I love that. I think of writing as these times where it's just me alone and digging into a piece of paper, you know, just constantly scribbling on it. But there's so much more than those experiences of just the work. Things that have been fruitful for me was the first time I ever went to a reading, which I think was in my 20s at some point in Boston. You know, I still pictured myself as a writer, but I wasn't really writing that deeply. And then I went to see the poet X.J. Kennedy, who I just remember as like a teenager really enjoying his structure and his rhymes. And so went to see him and I was like, oh, this is cool. I like this. I like hearing writing. There have been moments like that remind me that even when I'm finding this art form difficult and I'm wondering what is my place in it and whether this is worth my time or if I'm any good at it, that I have to remember I actually love the art form. And so hearing S.J. Kennedy that first time was something very special to me. Another thing that I found really important to me was towards the end of my MFA, I was really dragging and exhausted with various things happening, and had just wandered into a bookstore while I was out of town and picked up this one poet's book, just leafing through it. Her name is Jean Monahan. And I'd never met her, and I was just blown away by the work she had in there. And it just reminded me, oh, it doesn't have to be that some experts told you that poetry is beautiful, and so then you have to read it and believe it. Or if you don't believe it, you have to fool yourself into believing it because an expert said it was great. You can pick up something randomly, and it can touch you and move you. And I reached out to that poet and, you know, just said, you know, your work has meant a lot to me. And, you know, she was kind enough to send me another one of her books. And just to realize that we can build community within writing, that even though it feels isolating, like I said, the work of it feels like me sitting at some sort of hard surface, scribbling on pieces of paper. It's really that connection and that community that we build out of it. And so it's those moments where you, for me, where I've stumbled upon writing that has felt miraculous. And then I guess just for this collection, one thing that really struck me way back in the day before I even started this collection but has stuck with me is I did a bike trip across the country, and most of it was pretty boring. I'll be honest, like, it's tedium biking over and over. I mean, it was an important time for me, and it was something I'm very proud that I did, but I don't want to make it seem like it was an adventure the whole time out. But at one point I was in Montana and really struggling on some highway, and I was not good at cycling and I was out of shape, but was getting across this giant state, and I was like, wow, there used to be dinosaurs walking right here. And I just, that moment of realization that I am on a piece of land that has been around for so long, and how small I was in that, really was remarkable for me. And I think that some of that awe still exists in the writing that I did for this series.
And kind of in connection with that, the Space Boy section features a lot of dragons. You've got the dragon in the Dragon Scrimshaw poem, and then in one of the letters that Space Boy never received, the brother compares the shuttle taking off to a dragon. And does that deliberately connect with the dinosaurs that are featured in a lot of the extinction poems, or was that sort of a coincidence?
Yeah, I guess I like reptilian-like things, so I don't believe dragons are real, but I guess if dragons were, I think they'd be sort of in the world of reptiles, or, you know, I think they probably would have some similarity to some things that we've seen in the dinosaur world and dinosaur kingdom. But, you know, I think, yes, there are certain things that we as writers sort of fixate on, whatever those might be, and that hopefully we can take whatever that source material is and diversify it in a lot of ways. Those Space Boy poems versus, you know, the dinosaur poems at the end definitely came at different times and in different ways. But with with the dragons, I was just like, what would be a weird thing for a whaler to find out in the Arctic Ocean? You know, I just like the juxtaposition of the weird there. But what was really important to me too was that the sailor would end up just being sort of bored. It wasn't like that the dinosaur was a threat. It was more that, oh my gosh, there's this eternity being stuck on the ocean with just the bones of a dragon. I thought that was really fascinating. And so, yeah, I guess the idea of like bones, maybe bones is a source for me, a kernel of idea. And so that shows up certainly in the third quarter, the third portion of this book, mm-hmm. as well.
So while we're on a reptile kick,
yeah,
how about if we hear a poem, I think, from the middle section, the one about the lizard fights?
Oh, sure. Again, yeah, I guess I just, you know, you're not going to see a lot of dogs in my poems. I'm not really like a mammal guy. So maybe that's my challenge, start writing poems about furry things. Yes, let's see. This poem is called A Week's Pay Lost at the Lizard Fight. You drop your roll of Friday bills on the purple one with a thick black tongue because its yellow eyes haven't shifted from its opponent. A green skink clawing the walls of the box. Cold-footed gladiator wetting its corner. But when the fight ends with your pick split open, neck to rectum, organs spilt like pink confetti, you'll wander home thinking of how to win it all back. even at six, you'd ask your dad, what could kill what? Great white or gorilla? Cobra or buffalo? Neanderthal or green beret? Everything eyed in potential death matches. Every day, you find yourself standing across another new monster eager to empty your torso. You'll get lost, circle the city, forget your way home as you dream of a box big enough to fit you in one corner and the entire world in the other. You know, with that poem, so my dad is a huge boxing fan, so growing up we'd watch boxing all the time, and he'd always ask me before a fight, like, who's your manok? Manok in Tagalog, in the language of the Philippines, means chicken, because it's a large cockfighting, you know, culture. And so, you know, there's sort of a masculinity and a violence that's inherent in this idea of, like, fighting. And, you know, I just thought, what's a weirder way of doing it? And it would be using lizards fighting each other than chickens.
So there's not actually lizard fights as far as you know.
I don't know. You know what? People put money down on anything in this world. So people do weird things to entertain themselves. So maybe it would be worth researching. Maybe someone in the audience can Google if you can find lizard fighting. I don't think it's sanctioned anywhere in the U.S., but tell me if it turns out to be a real thing.
Well, there used to be cricket fighting in China.
See, there we go. Everyone, like, there's something weird about human beings where we want to see things in combat.
So I'd like you to read a couple more poems, and then I will have one more question.
Great. Standing naked in the forest at the height of mosquito season. Shoulder to wrist, this arm is yours. I will not swat the tender divide between bicep and tricep or the soft, hairless pocket of the elbow's crook. Needle your mouth for a sip and delight in blood's salty warmth as it flushes your cavities like a long pull of brandy. Let your shell shimmer with iron-laced heat. Call the others, the six-legged, the eight, the hundred, the thousand, the mandibles, proboscides, the spikes and wings, the ones that sting, the ones that poison, the ones that harbor infectious diseases, the ones that lay eggs in intimate hollows. From neck to crotch, this is yours. I will not flinch as my skin swells out, a bloated scarlet. I will not scream or curse your name to God. I don't blame you for your thirst. We all take, you know. We've all drunk someone dry. This poem is called Dirt Eaters Anonymous. So, you know, there's a condition where some people end up eating dirt. I don't remember what it's called, but this is vaguely inspired by that. Dirt Eaters Anonymous. Stare at her hands during dinner. Dirt under the nails is a sure sign of relapse. Ask, honey, how was your day? Did you garden? Watch her blush and squeak out a lie, so little air able to wheeze through her throat, her pinhole windpipe dammed back with black loam. Kiss her in bed and taste bitter topsoil, her lips cracked from leaves that suck the skin's moisture, leaving her brittle like yellowing edges of autumn. Run your tongue over her teeth and cut yourself on the twig stuck between. Don't fall asleep. Wait till she slips from under your arm, slips out the bedroom, slips into darkness, strips off her clothes and rolls in the grass, the bed of gardenias, munching on mulch till she's foaming, delirious. Don't call the doctor. It's not her fault. Maybe you thought since you'd been inside her, it was you she was missing. The way you fit seemed the circuit completed. You began to believe your presence belonged in all her hollow spaces. You forgot before she was yours, she was miles of elements pleated, sand and clay, wood and silt, an unbroken chain of molecules hooked like a harness to the earth that begot her. The pebbles know her longing. Let her fill the empty spaces. Let her find her way back home.
So now for a completely random question.
What's a
food you've always wanted to try and why?
Fugu, blowfish, because it could kill you, right? And so maybe you all remember that Simpsons episode where Homer eats sushi for the first time, loves it all, and then he has the fugu, and then he thinks he's going to die. But I was in Tokyo a while back, and I just saw all the fugu shops. And I was like, should I try this out? What about this is the appeal? But I don't think it's that it tastes good. It is maybe that just that ability to say, hey, I came close to danger. T.C. Boyle, though, writes a short story about it. And I think what he talks about is the idea that it tingles and numbs the mouth in some way. And so I guess that would be worth potentially trying someday.
All right, Armin, thank you very much.
Teal, thank you. This has been a delight.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some hope.
Dearly beloved,
yes, come ride your bike and dance the night away on Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m. as we celebrate Prince's birthday with a mobile bicycle dance party. Roll around Portland with Diablo as we rock Pedalpalooza, dropping the Prince jams all night long, stopping to dance along the way. Again, that's Prince's birthday celebration on Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m., beginning at his mural on 42nd and Prescott. More information can be found on the KBU website under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Good in the Hood the weekend of June 21st through 23rd at King School Park in Portland. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music, art, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experience to strengthen the unity in the community.
The Good in the Hood parade will take place Saturday starting at North Williams and North Russell Street at 11 a.m. and KBU will be broadcasting the festival live on Saturday starting at 2 p.m. and Sunday starting at noon. Again, that's Good in the Hood Friday, June 21st from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday, June 22nd from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. and Sunday, June 23rd from noon to 10 p.m. at King School Park in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
Good evening. My name is Gayatri Ramprasad. I'm the founder and president of ASHA International. Everyone has a story. Stories connect us, comfort us, let us know that we're not alone, and give us hope to cope, survive, and thrive. Stories have the power to save lives and create social change. Our story is our superpower. At ASHA International, we are dedicated to destigmatizing mental illness and promoting mental health and well-being at schools, in workplaces, and in the community through the power of storytelling. Tonight, incredibly courageous storytellers will share their stories of hope and resilience to raise awareness of mental health as an integral part of personal, organizational, and community wellness. Together, we will shine a light on mental health and end stigma, one story at a time.
My story, My Superpower, was recorded Wednesday, May 29th, in Hillsborough. The first story is by Diane.